Welcome to the Pennsylvania Department of Corrections Oral History Project, where we record the oral histories of current and former DOC employees. I'm DOC Communications Director Susan McNaughton. This oral history focuses on memories from the October 1989 riot at the State Correctional Institution at Camp Hill. Our guest today, September 9th, 2019, is John Polakovich. Thank you for joining us, John.
Thank you. I'm glad to be here.
Before we begin, could you provide us with a brief overview of your DOC career? Tell us where you worked and the different titles that you've held, please.
Briefly, I began my career with the Department of Corrections in 1976 at SCI Camp Hill. I worked as a vocational evaluator, inmate employment officer, superintendent's assistant, deputy superintendent for treatment, deputy superintendent for operations, and superintendent at SCI Smithfield, then returned to Camp Hill as superintendent and retired in April 2010.
Okay, thank you. So again, this is about the memories of the Camp Hill prison riot, and I've interviewed a number of different people from other superintendents somewhere else in the system, hostages, general employees who were working inside and outside of the institution at the time. But you were kind of a special employee because in addition to being the superintendent's assistant, you also were the public information officer. So I want to hear about all aspects of your job. So let's start with, it's about 2:30, 3 o'clock on Wednesday, October 25th, 1989. Where are you and what's happening?
Approximately that time, I was underneath one of the cell blocks. It was C block at the time, working with the Deputy Attorney General, Francis Flippy. We had a major asbestos abatement lawsuit going on at the time, and we heard the call for general lockdown. I determined that there was a problem. I escorted Francis out of the institution and went back to the main command post.
And that command post was in the superintendent's office in the prison administration building?
No, the command post at that point was inside at the deputy superintendent's office by the beside the control center in group one.
Okay. So what happened after you got there?
When we got there, we had a view of where the incident occurred at E Gate, and we could tell it was a major disturbance. And I was actually in the office there for about an hour or so before I was able to get outside the institution back to the superintendent's office because I knew we would be flooded with a number of press calls coming in from the incident.
Okay, and then when you went back out to the administration building, sure enough, you had press calls waiting, I'm sure.
I had numerous press calls, yes. I was getting calls from everyone and anyone about regarding what was going on. We set up an initial briefing. It was probably shortly before 6 p.m. And of course, all the local media were there. We had the briefing across the Lisburn Road near the abattoir.
Mm-hmm. And as the incident continued, what was one of the main things you learned with respect to the placement of your media briefing area during an incident?
First, it was too close to the center of what was going on, to the institution. Again, hindsight is 20/20, as we all learned from the incident, from the riot.
Mm-hmm.
The briefing area was too close to incoming personnel, police, and other emergency people coming into the institution. And it created a problem because the media at that point had direct visual line of sight on what was going on inside the institution.
And also immediately right outside the institution, there was all of the first responders and EMS were triaging injured individuals.
That's correct. Triage area was immediately outside the administration building, and it was not a good situation.
Okay. So as the night continues, and you've given your first briefing, when was your second briefing? And by that time, how many reporters do you think were there?
There had to be at least 50, in my guess, best guess and recollection at this point. Second briefing was probably around 8 p.m.
Okay.
And after I initially did the first briefing, I remember going back to the office, and I was getting calls from the major networks, ABC, CBS, NBC.
Wow.
And they were asking me if they should send a crew to the institution.
And what did you say?
I said, I cannot answer that.
And so now, while you're the PIO at the facility, you also have a press person, a press secretary at the DOC level that you had to answer to. So what was your interaction then with the press secretary, Ken Robinson? Like, how did you communicate with each other? Did you come up and meet with him? How did that work for you?
We were initially communicating by phone. At some point that evening, he actually came down to the institution, mm-hmm. and we were in constant communication from then on out. Mm-hmm. So.
And tell me about how the first night ended and any media briefings explaining that process. How did it end? What had been promised to the inmates for the next day, if anything?
The first night ended basically with the agreement that the superintendent would meet with inmate representatives the next day. We had a briefing, I'm not sure exactly what time it was in the middle of the night. I know it was pre-dawn briefing saying that the issue was settled at that point. The superintendent was going to meet with the inmates and we had the briefing.
Okay. So was the facility secured at that time?
Well, again, hindsight is 20/20. The assumption was it was secured, but obviously it was not.
Right. And then I talked to a lot of people who talked about going in and securing the staff, or the staffs, going in and securing the inmates into the cells. And then things were pretty much quiet, like the inmates were fed?
It was quiet the next day. As I recall, superintendent was preparing basically for a news conference, a conference call with the governor's office in the early afternoon. The assumption was that the inmates were in their cells, but as, you know, investigation showed later that the panel boxes were available to the inmates from their cells. I could open them manually. But generally during the day, it was tense, it was quiet the entire day. Superintendent did meet with, and the two deputies met with the inmates. I wasn't in on that meeting, so mm-hmm. I couldn't tell you what actually went on.
Okay.
And superintendent, we all went to central office in the early afternoon. We had a conference call with the governor.
Okay, and then around 6:30, we're talking on October 26th, where were you and what was happening?
I was in my office returning press calls. The superintendent had a press briefing late afternoon. That was aired on the 6 p.m. news, obviously.
Mm-hmm.
And I finished a call with a reporter, forget what was from the Patriot News, forget what his name was at the time. I was going to go back inside the institution to see how things were before I went home, and I decided against it.
Oh.
So I left the institution about 6:15, got home. I remember this vividly. I told my wife, don't take the phone off the hook and I went to bed. 2 hours later, she did take the phone off the hook. 2 hours later, she put it back on, and immediately it was Ken Robinson telling me I had to come back to the institution.
Wow. Okay, so when you came back into the institution, or were coming back towards the institution, what did you see? What was happening?
Camp Hill sits at the base of Slate Hill Road and Lisburn Road, and as I came across the top of the hill coming down towards the institution, it looked like an inferno. The entire institution was basically up in flames. Looked like napalm had hit. Obviously, there were more police there, more emergency personnel at the institution when I got there, and I went back into the office.
Wow. So then, of course, there were more media briefings, and talk to me about what was going on. Were you in the command center then? Were you with the superintendent?
Yes, the command center had been moved out to the superintendent's office, so I was in the command center.
You were?
The whole night.
Okay.
Yes.
Okay. So lots of activity, obviously, and talk to me about the way that officers were able to communicate with staff to let them know that they were in trouble. I've talked to other people who said back then we didn't have radios like we have now. So individuals who were trapped or who were about to be taken hostage were calling control asking for help?
That's correct. There weren't as many radios throughout the institution as we have today. And staff would be making calls into the command center, telling us where their location was and requesting help.
That must have been awful to listen to.
That was awful, but probably the hardest part was when they brought the injured staff members out, and many of them I knew very well, and they were battered,
right.
Several of them.
Now that second night, there were a number of staff who were trapped above or in the control area inside the institution and then above control. Can you talk to me about how many people, why were they there, and how they were rescued?
I believe there was 20 to 30 people in that immediate building, in the control center building in Group 1, because
wow.
That housed the deputy superintendent's offices and the treatment clinic offices, the counselors and psychologists. Records office was in that area. And when the second night of the riot started, the inmates were able to come through the gate that separated where most of the action had taken place the first night, and they came right for the control center area. That's where all the keys were located, that's where emergency equipment was located. And the staff were initially downstairs. They got to the second floor of the building. They were basically surrounded by the rioting inmates, and they had to wait for the state police to come in, and there was a fire company, I guess, had a ladder, got them out the second-story window.
Wow, and the accounts that I've read and also heard from people that I've interviewed is that the inmates actually broke in through the air conditioning units that were in the windows, and they just set everything on fire, I guess, and the smoke really is what forced the staff to move up. Is that true?
Oh, yes, that's true. They pushed the air conditioning units in through the windows and set fire to the first floor of the building.
And there were actually some inmates with that group of 20 to 30 people.
There were a few inmates with the staff, yes.
Okay, so after they were rescued and they got those individuals out, well, that must have been an incredible sight to see. Did you actually see that happening?
No, I did not see that part. I had gone home that evening, and I just missed it, or I would have been part of that myself.
Wow. Okay, so they had been rescued by the time you showed up at the institution?
Yes, they were outside the institution when I showed up.
Okay, so I wanted to just go back to the fact that I had heard that you were trapped inside. And
the first day I was basically trapped inside. We couldn't go anywhere from where we were locked down.
Okay.
And I wasn't, I guess you could consider that trapped, but I wasn't trapped. I wasn't in any harm's way at that point. I just could not get outside the institution.
Okay. And I guess from Ken Robinson trying to reach his PIO and he can't reach you because you're stuck inside the institution, that must have been a little panicking for him.
Yeah, that was a little panicking, yes.
So I also recall that you had been up for a long amount of time before the riots actually started. Is that true? Like, why? Go ahead.
Well, I normally would get into the office 6:30 in the morning, so I was there around morning prior to the riot at 6:30, the first day. I stayed until roughly 4 to 5 o'clock the next morning of October 26th. I went home, came back in the office by 7, and I was there until 6 p.m. on Thursday evening.
Right. So that's a long time.
I went home, got my 2 hours sleep, and I was back. When I went back to the institution on Thursday night, I got home Saturday morning.
Okay, wow. So talk to me about what it's like to handle media inquiries when you're tired, when you're concerned about the people inside that you know are being hurt, and how did that reveal itself? Do you remember?
Well, during the time it was happening, I guess I was running on adrenaline. I was able to just focus on what I was telling the media. The frustrating part, probably the most frustrating part, is with that number of media there, there's always somebody showing up late. They missed the initial statement and the initial round of questions, and then start asking the same questions over and over.
Mm.
And probably the highlight of it all was the second night of the riot. I was had a press briefing outside, and somebody asked the question, are they trying to burn the place down? And of course the fires are burning behind me, and I just turned around, looked at it, turned back to the press and said, obviously.
And then what happened?
Funny in times like that.
I think I recall the press secretary said, I think we need to give
John
a break.
That's when he pulled me out.
So we know that, and we had, all PIOs had backup PIOs at that time too, so that was probably a good time to bring in your PIO, which I believe, your backup, which I believe is what happened, and that was Ed Ulsh.
Ed Ulsh was my backup PIO, correct.
Right, and then I think over the late night hours, they brought him in to handle some media calls, or media briefings as well. I think I remember him and our deputy, Sherry Cadell, at the time, were handling media. So, go ahead.
They did do a media briefing. It was like at 3 a.m. in the morning, and I was there. I just wasn't doing the briefing.
Oh.
But I remember that, and it was a crucial time in the negotiations to release the hostages.
Oh.
So it was probably the worst time to put a backup person in, but I was exhausted at that point, obviously.
Right, and so the local media was, even at 3 a.m., were they covering this live?
Yes, they were.
Oh.
There was local media there. Yeah.
So there you are in the middle of critical negotiations, early wee morning hours, and your backup is doing the briefings. Boy, that must have been nerve-wracking. I mean, not that Ed, you know, wasn't qualified, but you had to be very cognizant of the fact that whatever information you released, the inmates were listening to.
Exactly. Yes, it was a very tense time. It was a very, very tense time.
Mm.
And I still feel bad that we had to put Ed in that position, but it's just the way it worked out.
Right. And then, so like you said, the critical negotiations were going on. Tell me how that day ended, and when you what was the rest of your day like?
The riot ended, I guess the state police went in about 6:30, quarter to 7 in the morning. And there were shots fired. The inmates went back to their cells, and that basically ended the riot. The remainder of the day after that, I'm drawing a blank right now what I did that day. I know I was at work that day. We were starting to find out what was going, who were the injured people. We had all the hostages accounted for. Then we began the process of what are we going to do with all the inmates that are out in the exercise field.
So as being the superintendent's assistant and also the PIO, were you able to actually do any superintendent assistant work, or were you all focused on PIO duties?
At that point, it was all PIO duties, but at some point, I was in the command post more and more, the press briefings, as I recall, were eventually taken over by Ken Robinson, and Central Office was doing the major briefings.
Okay.
After the riot concluded.
Okay. Wow. So tell me what happened then afterwards. Like, how did we get inmates out and transferred out? Like, what went into all of that?
The plan was to transfer the inmates to other institutions throughout the state initially. That was the first step, to get the inmates that were out of their cells into another institution. So we had to physically go down on the field, identify inmates, put them on a bus, the buses. First bus left Friday night, probably close to midnight. There were like six buses going out to, I believe it was Waymark, the first institution that received inmates.
Right.
They were escorted by state police, but we were trying to identify inmates, if you can imagine this, on a darkened field by flashlight and pictures.
And also, there was damage to the records office, right? So that also compounded.
That hindered the operation too. Yeah. Fortunately, all the files weren't totally destroyed, but there were a number of files destroyed.
Wow. All right. So you identify the inmates as best you can. Like maybe you know that you're just not sure that this person is who this person says he is, right?
Well, part of it was that I got sent out to the field to identify inmates because I knew a lot of the inmates.
Oh.
So I could identify them by myself, you know. You know, you call a name out and 10 guys just say, oh, I just want to get out of here. we identified inmates, loaded the buses, and got them out of there.
Wow. Talk a little bit about what, you know, looking back, were the causes of the riot.
Well, the causes of the riot were numerous. The biggest thing was, I would say, it was overcrowding. The institution was not built for that many inmates. It was designed for 1,300 inmates. We had close to 2,600 inmates, I believe, at the time. We had added additional housing units, dormitory units, etc., over time. We were understaffed. There was a lack of programming for the inmates. It was probably one of the biggest things, lack of jobs. And a shortage of money to keep up doing routine maintenance.
Wow. Some people had talked.
One other factor on that. At that period of time, we were in a transition. We, you know, the institution, Camp Hill, was designed for juveniles.
Right.
As everybody will know. But we had transitioned to adults, and the type of offender we had at the time was becoming much more serious offenders. We had a lot of parole violators were there that weren't happy. They aggravated the situation. And we had, you know, there were a number of groups that were trying to create disturbances for us.
Right. The Fruit of Islam group played a pretty big role in that, I believe.
They were the center of it, in reality, yes. They had the controlling factor, yes.
And then other things that I heard that HIV/AIDS was relatively new back then, and I think they were trying to mainstream some of the HIV/AIDS patients or inmates into general population, and that caused a concern for the inmates in the population, not only there but at other facilities. Huntington had an issue a couple of days before the Camp Hill issue, so I heard that was an issue.
I wouldn't totally put too much weight on that. We were dealing with HIV inmates since 83.
Oh, okay.
84, we did have a housing unit in our medical department for 10 to 12 of those guys, and we had put them out in population. And we didn't get a big reaction at Camp Hill.
Okay.
But some of the other institutions may have, yes.
Okay. And then I heard that there was a change in policy about sick line?
That was probably one of the biggest contributing factors. They wanted to change the policy from 5 days a week to 3 days a week, mm-hmm. for sick line.
Mm-hmm.
Again, that all factored in with the money being short at the time.
Oh, and then the family days.
Inmates were not happy about it, right?
And they lost their family days, so it was kind of like
And family days was probably the biggest thorn under the inmate's saddle.
So can you explain to me and the listeners what was family day and what was the problem with family day that it had to be stopped?
Family day was a tradition throughout the Department of Correction where once a year an inmate's family could come into the institution, basically bring a picnic style lunch and spend the day outdoors on picnic tables, spend the time with their family. The problem with it was obviously people are bringing in food items. That's a natural way to bring in contraband in the institution. And again, when you have 2,600 inmates versus the original 1,000, 1,200 inmates, different kind of inmate culture, it was just too many things were being brought in the institution that way. Staff were just unable to check what was being brought in.
Certainly was a concern.
The superintendent at the time, we had announced that this was going to be the last year for family days, and inmates were not happy about that.
So the stopping of family days, was that just specific to Camp Hill then, or did, like you said, it was a department-wide thing. Did other institutions stop theirs?
I shouldn't say it was department-wide. It was a Camp Hill tradition. Again, that goes back from the days of it being a juvenile facility.
Okay. Wow. And then moving forward after the riot, so obviously moving forward after the riot, Superintendent Freeman was then let go and was replaced by Jeff Beard. Tell me what that was like.
I will give the greatest credit to Jeff Beard. He was probably the one person that could get the institution moving. After the riot, the inmates were locked down. It was over a week. The inmates were still locked in their cells. When Jeff Beard came into the institution as a superintendent, he said, "Why are we continuing to do this? We need to start loosening things up. We need to move forward." Staff was still in shock. Nobody wanted to do anything for the inmates. And he started to get things moving in the institution, and he basically was able to rebuild Camp Hill.
Wow. And so talk about the physical rebuilding of Camp Hill. How was that facility rebuilt?
Basically from inside out. First thing we did was remove all of the debris. We had 8 to 10 dormitory facilities there. 8 of those were burnt to the ground, so we had to remove all that debris. 16 of the 32 buildings inside the fence were partially or totally destroyed. So it was basically a demolition job first, after we got a number of inmates out, and then we had to start planning to rebuild the institution, and that was the beginning of the modular construction, and the cell blocks were built one at a time. We had to move inmates around. It was a long process.
Right. I do recall that they did start, when they started to tear down the 6 main cell blocks that were involved, they had to put a temporary sally port in the perimeter gate to be able to bring in the modular components of the new housing units that they were building. So that was kind of interesting. And
yes, we have a secondary sally port on the west. It'll be the west side of the institution for not only the modular units, but the construction crews and everybody that's going in and out. So.
Right.
Because we were running two institutions. We were building an institution, rebuilding an institution, and maintaining what was left of the institution at the same time.
Wow. And of course, throughout this whole time, there was a continual state police presence. Tell me what it was like when it was time to release the state police. How did staff feel about that? And do you remember when that was, like how long after the riot?
Well, it was a very gradual reduction of number of state police. I forget the total number we had immediately after the riot, but initially there were state police in every cell block that housed inmates after the riot. It was a step-down process. And then it went from the cell blocks, and then we had them staged inside the institution for a while. And then the next phase was we removed them from part of the institution, but we had a small group still inside the institution. And then we had a group of state police that were stationed right outside the institution in the administration building. And then eventually the numbers were reduced as things were going. Staff were very uneasy about having state police leave the institution. But it was the only way that could get back to normal by getting the state police out of the institution.
Right, and that phasing down sounds like
the final ones were finally, it was almost, a little over a year. I think it was like in January of, it'll be 1991.
Wow.
The final ones left, yes.
That is a long time. But like you
it
said,
was a long time, yes.
I mean, but the staff, like you said, that shock lasted for quite a while, I'm sure. And speaking of that shock, so let's talk about how the DOC worked to debrief individuals. Did you go through a debriefing?
No, I did not.
No, you did not. Okay.
Everybody else did. I did not go up.
So was that by choice?
That was by choice, yes.
Okay.
I made excuses not to do it. So.
Oh, okay. So tell me how the stress from all of this impacted you and your family. How did it show itself?
Probably in more ways than I'll ever know. I guess I was so involved. I had a media briefing once a day for the next 9 months after the riot.
Wow.
I was doing two or three a day, and then it went down to one, at least once a day. And I was getting calls every day from, you know, primarily local media and state media. But I can remember dealing with press every day for 9 months about the riot. So I guess I was under a lot of stress. I always say the salvation was Superintendent Beard at the time was graceful enough to let me take a 7-week vacation over the summer, and I took a long trip and forgot about everything. So.
Wow.
Yeah.
7 weeks. Wow.
Yeah, we had a motorhome at the time. We took a trip across country.
Good
it had been planned the year before, but
okay.
You didn't have to let me do that. So.
Nice.
That probably kept me in corrections. Otherwise, I probably would have left.
But what was it like to come back after 7 weeks being free of it all?
It seemed like I just jumped right back into the routine.
Okay, so you were kind of rejuvenated?
Rejuvenated. Everything new was starting to come along with the institution. I could see it being rebuilt and everything. I was part of that. The time passed very, very quickly for the next 10 years, I'll put it that way.
Yeah. And of course, there's always the rumor that somebody was killed during the riot. And I've talked to several people who know firsthand that no, that is not true. But can you confirm for me that no one was killed during the riot?
No one was killed during the riots. That rumor continued because we had not been able to clear the physical count after the riot. And it took us probably 10 to 12 days before we finally figured it out. And what happened was when we were transferring inmates out, everything was being handwritten, obviously. And copies were being made of all of the documents. And on one of the transfer groups that went out to the federal system, we finally found it on one of the original copies. There was a misprint or a double entry or whatever it was.
Oh.
But we were able to clear the count. And I kept getting calls, you know, we hear there's someone dead, you know, have you cleared count yet? We said, no, we haven't cleared count yet. Why is there a refrigerator truck parked behind the kitchen area? Well, that's to keep the food cold, but that rumor persists.
Wow. Amazing.
Yes.
So, looking back on all of this, are there any major like snippets or scenes in your mind that you recall or flash back to that you'd like to share, or interesting stories?
Oh, probably a thousand, but I'm thinking.
Okay.
Probably the one that's still most vivid is when the hostages were coming out from inside the institution, and like I said, they were bringing them to the lobby of the administration building. And I had just finished up, I was just going out to a press conference, and one of the staff members was out there, and he was covered with blood, basically. He had head wounds, so there's a lot of blood with the head wound. I saw him, and then I had to go out and face the media.
Mm.
That was probably the toughest one.
Right. Like I said, it must be very difficult to know all of these individuals and to have to go out and just be so matter of fact when you're addressing the media. That can be difficult to have that kind of poker face, I would think.
It's much harder. harder than you can describe, you know, to be honest with you.
And were there incidents where the media was showing like a diagram of the institution and kind of telling about our tactical attacks?
Yes, there were. There's an instance where they had a diagram and they were asking specific questions.
Wow. And can you
point that out?
Yeah, can you explain to the listeners why that obviously would be a problem?
Well, it's obviously a problem because you're putting in danger the rescuers as well as the hostages. Well, they're going into that area. When the tactical team's going in, it's an element of surprise, and if the inmates know they're coming,
and the
puts everyone in danger.
And the inmates could see this because, like I said earlier, the local networks actually preempted their network shows and were showing everything live.
They were showing everything live, and the inmates, most of the inmates had TVs in their cells at the time.
Wow.
You know, and since it was local, they didn't even have cable. I mean, they could just get it on an antenna. So they were watching it. They were listening to it on the radio.
Amazing. And then did you ever have any problems with individuals running around among the media spreading rumors?
There were people talking to the media, and we could not control that.
So right.
We just had to dispute the rumor and, you know, try to give the right answers.
Right. Well, John, I think that's it. I just wanted to give you another chance if you had anything else that you wanted to share that we might have missed.
No, I think that's it.
Okay. So thank you very much. Like I said,
here's an interesting thing.
Oh, okay.
The first night of the riot, or was the second night? One of the first night of the riot, I guess it was, when they were going to try to relocate the inmates to other institutions, one of the options was going to Waymar, which was still technically a Department of Welfare facility. Our neighbor at the time, she was the Secretary of Welfare, Karen Snyder. She kept calling the institution. She called Department of Corrections. She could not get through. So she called my wife at home and told her that the institution would be ready to take inmates at any time. My wife got a hold of me through my private line in the office and told me that. So I was able to relay that information to the Department of Corrections.
Wow. Great.
That's how chaotic it was at the time.
Yeah. I also interviewed Greg White and Chuck Zimmerman about the fact that they were standing in the commissioner's office, and he looked at them Friday and said, get ready. Go up and get the
right.
New prison ready. So I do have a little side interview about them bringing Waymart into operation faster than was planned.
Yeah. Yeah, but I forgot that. Yeah, she called my wife and said, I can't get a hold of anybody at the DOC and tell John that the institution's available.
Well, you know, at the time when everything started kicking off, the phone system just couldn't handle everything. We were getting calls from reporters, and the switchboard down at the institution was getting calls from everybody. So.
Oh, yeah, that was just crazy. It was just total chaos.
Yeah.
And you had all the family members of the inmates calling in.
Mm-hmm.
You had all the staff members' families calling in trying to find out where people were.
Right.
I know I had several friends, their wives called me and said, you know, so-and-so hasn't made it home yet. I said, I know he's... You know, I couldn't say he's a hostage at that point, but, you know, it was crazy.
Right.
Totally crazy. So,
thanks, John. Take care.
Good talking with you. Bye-bye.
Bye-bye.